Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Um zu verstehen, was heute passiert, müssen wir wissen, was bisher geschah.
Genau dafür gibt es unseren neuen Geschichtspodcast. Von politischen Intrigen im antiken Rom über die fanatischen Sektenführer in der frühen Neuzeit bis hin zu den großen Eroberern des Mongolischen Reichs und ihren Management-Skills.
Ich bin Joachim Telgenbischer.
Ich bin Nils Minkmar.
Und wir finden heraus, was bisher geschah, um zu verstehen, was heute passiert. Höre, was bisher geschah, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The Metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the Metaverse are having impact today.
From the BBC World Service, this edition of the documentary podcast, Forward Thinking, is the third of four programmes recorded at the Oxford Literary Festival with The Telegraph. And we're asking, can veganism feed the world and save the planet in the process? We're asking this at Worcester College. Green lawns outside, of course, this eminent location of learning. Wonderful to have both of my guests here with me. Gary Francione, welcome.
Thank you.
And also Ron Weiss, welcome.
Thank you, Noah.
Let me begin with you, Gary. Veganism is abstaining from all animal products. Do you think veganism can save the world?
I think veganism is the only thing. I mean, if we do not go vegan, we won't save the world. I mean, think about it. Half of the habitable land on the planet is devoted to agriculture, with 80% of that involving livestock and only 20% of it producing food that humans eat directly. The inefficiency is profound. As a result of animal agriculture, we're having deforestation, decimation of species, water pollution. If we all went vegan, we would reduce the amount of land being used for agriculture by 75%. If everyone had a vegan diet, we would have no problem feeding 9.5 billion people. If we do not, with a standard American diet, we can feed 15% of them.
But it's not happening. We'll talk about why in a moment. Ron, you call yourself a vegan-friendly farmer. Talk me through that. Are you vegan?
I am, by definition, vegan, but I don't necessarily use the term vegan to describe my eating style.
That's really interesting. And a vegan-friendly doctor as well.
Yeah. As a doctor, I hope I'm a friend to all who are in search of wellness.
What decides how you eat then, Ron? Because I'm curious about how you come into this world of veganism, even if it's not exactly what you practice.
When I first started on my journey, it was because of health. That was the reason why I adopted my eating style, which I refer to as a diet of whole plant foods.
What does that mean?
Well, it is a vegan diet in that I don't consume any animal products, but I would characterize it as beyond vegan because the word whole plant foods, when they're put together, identifies the quality of the vegan diet, whereas many vegan diets may be of poor quality and disease-causing. A diet of whole plant foods is a vegan diet which is health-promoting and not only prevents chronic illnesses, but reverse them.
Really interesting. What about you, Gary? What got you into veganism?
I became a vegetarian in the 1970s after visiting a slaughterhouse. And then in 1982, I was introduced to veganism, actually by a British person. I heard the word vegan for the first time. That was in October of 1982. And I don't wear leather. I don't wear wool. So it's not just a diet thing. I mean, I talk mostly about a vegan diet. But Ron is right to say that you can have an unhealthy diet. I mean, you can eat potato chips and you can be a very unhealthy vegan. So he's talking about being a healthy vegan, eating whole plant foods.
So we're going to get into that, the nutrition. But I want to turn to our audience that we have here. Wonderful to see so many of you with us to speak about veganism. Right. I want a show of hands. We're going to find out who's in the room here. Don't be shy. It's a judgment-free zone, from me anyway. How many vegans in the audience? Okay, I'm going to say maybe there's 5 to 7% of who is here. Omnivores, eat everything. That's about half. Vegetarian, that's probably the rest, actually. Interesting. Carnivores, meat only. No, nobody admitting to that one anyway. Okay, so there's a number of vegetarians that are here. So you or the omnivores, I have a question for you. Why not vegan? Anybody give me an answer? Don't be shy. Lady in the front here with the blue jumper. What's your name and where are you from and welcome?
Hi, I'm Annie. I live in London and I'm a vegetarian because I find that vegan diets can be difficult to maintain.
Any particular aspect of that?
Eating out at restaurants, sometimes cooking for yourself, it requires you to be more conscious about your decisions.
What about that, Gary? I'll start with you before we get into the nutrition aspects of it.
When I first became a vegetarian, I ate a lot of cheese pizza, which I really enjoyed. And then when I became a vegan, I couldn't eat that anymore. I chose not to eat that anymore. I would sort of think about whether I wanted a slice of pizza. And I always thought, you know, there's really nothing I want to put in my mouth that badly where I'm going to support a cow being constantly impregnated, having her baby taken away from her almost immediately after birth, one of the saddest things I've ever seen, and seeing her emotional reaction and realizing that cow's going to be in the same slaughterhouse in 6 years.
I know you're saying don't draw a line between the two, but many people that become vegan become vegetarian first. So I would imagine you would encourage people to move.
They become vegetarian first because that's how it's presented to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, make your own choices, but I'm not going to tell you that eating dairy products is any better than eating meat. I don't think it is.
But that is, you're talking about really the animal welfare part of being vegan, where some might have it instead as climate change, health issues. There's lots of different reasons that people might decide to go vegan.
True. I mean, I think the health reasons are equally compelling with dairy products. And dairy products are also very bad for the environment. So, I mean, again, it's really hard to draw lines in any of those contexts.
So that might be some of your reasoning or perhaps trying to convince people.
Sure.
Anybody else like to chime in on why they are not vegan? Yes, lovely. This lady here, please. Thank you. What's your name? You're very welcome.
Hello, my name's Angela Wilson. I'm a GP. I'm not vegan partly because I haven't been able to wean myself off cheese and also catering for a family where two members of the family do not have any intention at the present time of becoming vegan. So it's actually really difficult to coordinate family life that way. What I would say, I'm going to put in a word for my patients, if that's okay.
Please do.
We have a lot of discussions about the fact that it's actually just not affordable for a lot of people to actually be buying this healthy fruit and veg.
Yes.
It's cheaper to buy the really cheap ultra-processed foods.
Yes. What about that, Ron?
That is a problem. I'm not exactly sure of the entire situation as far as price supports and the economics in the UK's agricultural system. However, in the United States, the reason why the ultra-processed and unhealthy foods and the animal foods are relatively reasonably priced is because they enjoy federal support from the USDA, and about 7%, definitely less than 10% of the agricultural crops that are grown in the United States are the fruits, the vegetables, the seeds, and the nuts. The rest of them are essentially grains and feedstock for animals.
Obviously, we're speaking to a global audience here, and each country will have its own institutions and framework set up when it comes to that. But go ahead,
Ron. The other thing I might add is that as a farmer, because we are vegetable farmers, we grow vegetables with organic regenerative methods of vegetables, fruits, and grains. Grains are very much less labor intensive than growing vegetables and fruits. And so if you are going to grow them conscientiously and not use labor-saving, destructive chemicals and machinery that's driven by petroleum products, it's going to be more expensive.
Gary, you want to jump in?
I think actually what's expensive to be a vegan is if you are buying processed vegan foods. If you're eating just fruits, vegetables, beans, grains, seeds, it's almost always cheaper.
Let me come back to you. Would you like to respond? Because your patients are seeing it, right, that it is too expensive.
Yeah, and there's actually been studies in this country looking at income and how much percentage of your income is being spent on food and what you would have to spend in order to actually have this healthy diet. For some people, it's literally they don't have enough money coming in.
Hey, go ahead, Ron.
I want to now give a more fully rounded response to you, Dr. Wilson. And I would like to comment on what you said before, Gary, in that eating vegan is easy, because I don't think it is.
Do we have to acknowledge that?
Yes, we should acknowledge it, and I'll tell you why it's not easy. But first, I'd like to address
this. Dr. Wilson, yes?
So in order to stay alive, the thing that we really need is we need calories. Calories is a measurement of energy. The cheapest, lowest cost energy in food is starch. It's not vegetables. Fruits have some carbohydrate sugars in them, but they're not considered starch. The grains, the whole grains, legumes, the potatoes, I would be shocked if you were to show me animal products, fish, chicken, meat, that is not many times the price per pound as these starches that I just mentioned.
Could I just ask a quick question? Is it difficult to be vegan? I'm going to start with the lady. Hi, nice to meet you. What's your name?
Hello, Nicola. My husband was vegan before I was, and I didn't understand why. And I thought, well, why don't you just eat unprocessed food? You know, I think the thing that I was resisting was the cultural impact of it. I said, we're never going to be invited to the neighbours again. Food is about love. It's about sharing.
Do you still get invited to the...
Yes, and my neighbours will go, oh, you know, it's a vegan meal, it's vegan, I found this and it's vegan. And lots of things are accidentally vegan as well.
Sure. May I speak to the lady who's beside you as well? Hi, what's your name?
Hello. Eliza.
Hi, Eliza. What do you find it difficult?
Well, no, I think it's in fact my son who's 8 who decided to become vegan because he's so concerned about the planet. So that's made me adopt that diet. And I would just say it just forces you to be more creative. And in fact, we eat so much better than we did before because we're discovering new things to eat, new ways to cook them, new ways to use spices. And we just feel very joyful when we're eating. There's no guilt because we know that we're not impacting the planet.
That is such an interesting word to use, joyful, because I think some of the words that might be used about veganism might be somewhat at the other end of the scale.
Go on, Gary. I don't regard it as a sacrifice at all. I regard it as a joy. And I also say to people, if you think it's difficult to be vegan, let me tell you, it's a lot more difficult for the animals that were not vegan. So if you're thinking about it from a moral point of view, it's...
Well, a moral animal point of view, which there can be different moralities. Go ahead.
Can I just say, it's not easy for everyone because of poverty and inequality. And if you've got to fill your kids' bellies with fried chicken and other garbage junk food because it's cheap, then I don't think it's right to make any judgment about that. But if you've got the capacity and the time to cook and to learn, and you know, then
it
why
is
wouldn't
a,
you?
It is a time aspect, because you were talking about getting creative with your son, as you mentioned, you know, making these meals and whatnot and thinking about it. But all that takes time. And this is one thing we know, and particular for people of lower economic incomes, they're generally time poor as well. You know, they're working longer hours, all that.
But I teach at Rutgers University. We have, and the law schools are located in Newark and Camden, two very poor cities. And I've spent a lot of time working with people in Newark and in Camden. And their complaint is all they have available to them is fast food. They want healthier food. So you try to get better choices for them so that they can get beans and rice at a local bodega, which is charging a lot more money for that.
Bodega's like a little local deli on the corner.
A little local store, yeah.
There was one more gentleman who was vegan down here. Do you mind letting me know whether you find it's easy or difficult to be vegan?
I'm finding it very easy to be vegan because fundamentally our culture is originally vegan anyway.
Where are you from?
Originally from India.
Mm-hmm.
And our base food is vegan. You know, we eat idli sambar or rice and sabji, and all these things are vegan. So it was just going back to what our parents used to eat and what our grandparents used to eat before we got colonized. So I really see animal agriculture as a form of colonization that's going on around the planet.
That's a very interesting point. Does anybody who is vegan find it difficult? You acknowledge that it is difficult, Ron. Tell me why.
That's because of cognitive bias.
And what do you mean by cognitive bias?
I don't think that being vegan is difficult once you're vegan and you're doing it successfully. It's the most delightful and joyful thing in the world because you become a healer yourself.
You feel quite emotional about that.
I do.
Do you want to explain that a little bit?
My portal of entry into eating plants was when I was a young doctor and I'd been trained in the conventional American medical system of drugs, procedures, hospitals. My father was diagnosed with end-stage metastatic pancreatic cancer. We took him to the best cancer hospital in the world. He was given 30 to 90 days to live. It was very advanced and didn't know what to do. They told him to go home and prepare for death. I took him home. I moved home to take care of him. So desperate, I went down to the public library and started to just pull books off the shelf on anything I could find, alternative things. Mm-hmm. And one of these books was a book on testimonies from cancer patients who had adopted a macrobiotic diet. It's a diet of whole plant foods. And there was one gentleman, and he had what my father had. I brought the book home. My father read it, and he got rid of his cognitive bias. And he said, I will do this. And we took him to Michio Kushi in Boston.
Which is?
He was the head of the macrobiotic movement in the United States in through the 80s and 90s. And he put my father on the most severe diet I could possibly imagine. And I thought it was mad. It was crazy.
Give us an idea. What was it or what was it?
Well, it was beyond vegan. It was a very limited diet of whole plant foods. It basically consisted of a lot of dark leafy greens. That was the base. A few whole grains like brown rice and barley, a lot of legumes, some root vegetables, but no fruits and no nightshade vegetables like potatoes, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and no oil. And my father was so excited, he dragged me home with my mother, who became the foot soldier, and started cooking this.
Yeah, somebody's
got to. I had to eat this. And I did. And my father, within 2 days, got off of his narcotic pain medicines. And within a week, he went back to his law practice. And within 2 weeks, he went to the gym. And within 3 weeks, he started running. And in 3 months, we got a CAT scan, and the tumors were a third reduced in size. And in 6 months, we got another one, and they were 50% reduced in size. And a year later, we went back to the cancer hospital, and we presented this to the doctor. And when the doctor asked my father what was responsible for his still being alive, my father started to talk about kale and brown rice and seaweed, and the doctor's eyes rolled up, and he changed the conversation to chemotherapy. And that's when I knew that I was going to be a different kind of physician. Mm. My father's life was extended many times mm-hmm. with this diet. He had an excellent quality of life, but the diet, the cancer eventually was so far advanced, overcame him. And after his passing, I moved out of the house and I went back to my old diet of eating chicken parmesan and sushi and all those things. And always a lot of plants. I would say it was plant forward. I always ate a lot of big salads. It was what would be considered today a very, very healthy omnivorous diet. Mm-hmm. And it took me 15 years from that point of my father's death to understand why I should eat plants, because of cognitive bias.
So for you to undo that cognitive bias to...
Yes. So I think what cognitive bias is, and this is why it makes it so difficult to adopt the plants, it's based on this beautiful saying that change is so difficult for human beings because they focus on what they have to give up instead of what they have to gain.
I mean, I don't.
I can see vegans that are in the audience. I now know who you are, nodding along in agreement. Right. Gary, thank you for sharing that.
I mean, I understand and agree that there's a cognitive bias. But I mean, for me, the main motivator is the moral motivator. And I still do not understand how people can, you know, love one animal. You know, they have their dogs or their cats or whatever. One animal is a member of the family and the other animal they stick a fork into. I just don't understand that.
Why do you feel there are not more people taking on with your message? Because, I mean, many would say that a vegan lifestyle, and we've touched on it a little with some of our guests that are here in the audience, that it can be a luxury lifestyle in some way in the Western world. For example, there are others that feel that they can't afford it, that they can't achieve it.
I don't see veganism at all as an elite lifestyle. I mean, in the United States alone, we feed enough grain to animals that we're going to slaughter for food. We could feed 800 million people. So I see continuing to eat animal products as the lifestyle that relegates many people in the world to starvation. We could feed the world if we were all vegan. There will be children who go to bed tonight hungry because people have the elite lifestyle of eating animal products.
And I agree with Gary.
I have more questions as well on the nutrition. Let me play a message that came into us. This is from Sheila, who's in Kampala in Uganda, on the nutrition aspect of veganism.
Just yesterday, I was advised by my doctor to eat more red meat. I am iron deficient.
So Sheila's saying they're advised by her doctor to eat more red meat because she's iron deficient. We often hear about that, right? B12, protein, when it comes to veganism, what are you going to do? Not everybody could afford expensive supplements.
Well, this is just false. Plants have iron in them.
How many plants?
More than enough iron. You should eat your caloric needs. You should eat enough energy to stay alive, and you too will get iron. The iron in meat is a particularly dangerous form of iron to eat.
Why?
Well, because it can become oxidized.
Meaning?
And, well, the iron becomes radicalized and then can damage your artery walls and then predispose you to increased heart attack and stroke risk. And that's not true of plant iron.
What I was reading was that we don't have enough data on veganism and its full health effects, that there is lower cholesterol and blood pressure, lower heart disease, lower diabetes and cancer. So that all sounds very good. But perhaps that bones could be slightly weaker in vegans, or that there's no significant lengthening of lifespan. I'd like to hear you both on this before we go to our break.
Cognitive bias.
Absolutely false.
You are listening to Forward Thinking. From the BBC World Service, this is the documentary podcast at the Oxford Literary Festival. I'm Nuala McGovern.
Um zu verstehen, was heute passiert, müssen wir wissen, was bisher geschah.
Genau dafür gibt es unseren neuen Geschichtspodcast. Von politischen Intrigen im antiken Rom über die fanatischen Sektenführer in der frühen Neuzeit bis hin zu den großen Eroberern des Mongolischen Reichs und ihren Management-Skills.
Ich bin Joachim Telgenbüscher.
Ich bin Nils Minkmar.
Und wir finden heraus, was bisher geschah, um zu verstehen, was heute passiert. Höre, was bisher geschah, überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. the metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
This is the documentary podcast. Welcome to Forward Thinking from the BBC World Service. We're here at the Oxford Literary Festival at Worcester College. We're asking, can veganism feed the world and save the planet in the process? And our conversation is with Gary Francione, professor of law and author on animal rights, and Ron Weiss, who is a farmer and physician. We're talking about some of the dilemmas, some of the possible solutions when it comes to veganism. And we're taking questions from our audience that is here with us at Worcester College. We've spoken a little bit about health and nutrition earlier in the programme. But I want to turn next to a question we got from India. This is from Afroz Alam.
What is the connection between being vegan and climate change?
What's the connection between being vegan and climate change? This is a question that was asked many times on the Facebook page and other digital platforms. Gary, how do you see it?
Every animal product requires more input, plant input. So for a gallon of milk, you're going to be using several pounds of plants to produce the milk. So any animal product is going to have an environmental impact.
I have another message that also came in, this time from Delhi, our last messenger from Hajipur. This is Anand. Let's listen.
Animal farming releases more carbon dioxide than all automobiles combined. 75% of all crops are used to feed livestock. We need more and more farmland, and the Amazon rainforest is contracting. Also read how much fresh water is wasted in the process of meat production.
Are those figures correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And what about those, though, that say that absolute veganism could have significant social and economic ramifications? And I'm not talking about good ones. For example, a result in job losses, income disparity in industries connected to animal husbandry, such as meat packing, animal feed production. What's meant to happen to all those people?
Well, I mean, I suppose that if we move to vegan production, people will move into vegan production. I mean, it's not that these people are going to be unemployed. They'll be doing different sorts of jobs. But I think that we also have to take a step back and say, what's going to happen to people if we don't move in this direction?
Ron,
what's going to happen to their jobs? What's going to happen to, there's going to be social dislocation. What's happening with species destruction as a result of animal agriculture is going to have an impact on many, many people. We're already seeing places being flooded. We're already starting to see climate migration. We're going to see a lot more of that. So it seems to me that it's not just a question of, well, we continue the way we're going, or we have some social dislocation. We're going to have that social dislocation if we don't go vegan.
The same argument is made by the coal industry. Well, what's going to happen to all the miners and the people working in the coal industry? Well, if the coal industry continues, there will not be a planet. And people have to readapt. They have to adopt different ways of living.
But how does that happen? Because I have spoken to many miners, particularly in US election seasons, and you know, it can definitely be an issue that gets people to the ballot box and perhaps voting for one candidate over another. And yes, at times it might be short-termism, but that is what people are sometimes up against for their family. I mean, what is the solution then for that adaption? Who should be taking control of it? How does it happen?
Well, to draw a simple line, I think it begins by eating plants. It begins by eating plants.
You're putting it on the individual, Ron. If you could turn the tide, right, or the opinion of people to eat plants,
yes,
that then the politicians will follow? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because, you know, I come from the great garden state of New Jersey. And our wonderful senator, Senator Cory Booker, has a favorite saying that change does not come from Washington. It comes to Washington, and it comes from the people. And because of funding and moneyed interests, I don't ultimately think that the large lever to move us on the path to survival will be through government policy. It comes from we the people.
Right. You can't impose this on people. But for example, if we start producing solar, if we move into different sorts of energy, we'll have to have people do those jobs. There's nothing that's going to stop us from retraining people who are doing coal mining to produce solar panels.
But there is one thing that has come up in conversations that I've had with the miners, for example, that they feel it is their culture and their tradition and the way that they have lived. You may call it cognitive bias, Ron, I don't know, but that they do not want to change in that way. And I know we're talking about the United States here, but I think we could probably broaden this out for other countries as well, that maybe veganism isn't even a conversation and it's not part of the diet either. It's like you eat what you can get and whatever traditionally has been there, and maybe it's been animal products.
People don't want to change, but we're confronting some serious situations, and I'm not sure that it's right to say that people have a meaningful choice in terms of we are facing planetary right. destruction.
And if I may add this, the people who you are referencing probably are adults who probably have children or families. If you are a parent, your children's or grandparent, your children's and grandchildren's lives take precedence over yours. You would do anything, wouldn't you, to save your child's life or your grandchild. So if that's the case, and we know that our world is in such dire straits, why not just eat plants? Why not give up the meat?
Part of the problem is the empirical problem of we have politicians who are saying to people, oh, coal's fine, let's have more coal. People need to be educated better. People are told things which are absolutely false. And so they're saying, well, why do I have to stop mining coal? Because coal's wonderful. Well, it's not wonderful, and that's a fact.
When it comes to meat, though, coming back to a global perspective, I think we probably see an expansion of animal products being eaten in countries that wouldn't have eaten them previously. Any questions in the audience? I just want to stop for a moment and take a hello. I'll get a microphone to this gentleman in the front. Thank you very much.
I'm thinking back to the time when I was young and everybody smoked. Mm. Every movie you went to, there was somebody with a cigarette hanging out of their mouth and they weren't able to recite the lines because they had so much ash falling. And this is something which I think we've got to take advantage of and see in what way can governments change. And I was interested in what you said about the senator saying the change comes to Washington. But at the same time, the reality is there's ginormous businesses. And I'm interested also in recent years that cell-based meat is developing, whereby cells of meat can be taken and extracted. And then the food that you get is actually free of antibiotics, free of steroids, of additives, of all kinds. But most of all, it's free of cruelty to animals.
Let's talk about the lab meat. We hear, you know, various discussions. What about trying something like that if it's cruelty-free? The origin is animal, but it's not having the same suffering as the slaughterhouses that you spoke of.
Right. I just think it's important for us to get away from this paradigm that if we're not eating flesh at every meal, that there's something wrong. The problem is that the lab meat reinforces this idea that eating flesh is the normal state of affairs. I also think that it's going to be a long time before that becomes economically viable. You know, there are a lot of economic interests, pharmaceutical companies. I mean, you know, Ron is from New Jersey. I teach at the State University of New Jersey. It's dominated by pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, most of the antibiotics don't go to humans. They go to animals because the animals are under such stress. They're sick all the time, so they're taking antibiotics. So we're talking about enormous economic interests. It's complex. But I agree with you. We need governments to provide the message, but I also agree we need people to sort of change and sort of change their thinking.
Ron, what about that, the lab-grown meat?
I am a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason...
Is the Impossible Burger that?
No, it's not.
That's something else. Okay.
I wouldn't be a fan of that.
Impossible Burger is something that very much resembles the taste, smell of meat. I bought a taco off it once and it did taste pretty much like meat, but you would consider that kind of junk food,
right,
meat or junk
food
vegan?
That's an ultra-processed plant food, Impossible Meat or Beyond Meat. Mm. And basically what it is, it's expensive plant protein, like legumes and oils that are extracted and turned into a meat substitute, whereas the cellular meats are actually animal flesh that has been cloned from a single cell in a laboratory into pieces of meat.
But you're a fan?
I'm not a fan for human health. I view myself as two kinds of doctors now. I started off my life as one kind of doctor, where I was a doctor for humans, and now I'm a doctor for planetary health, for the Earth's health. And when I started off my life as a doctor, I started as an emergency room physician, and I worked in a large city hospital by myself at night. It was very busy, and oftentimes they would bring in multiple critical patients at the same time. Like sometimes there would be a knifing, plus someone who was having a heart attack, plus someone who had stopped breathing.
Who do you
tend to first? And that's called a triage emergency. You have to use your judgment to decide which person gets my attention first. It's the person who stopped breathing. And in this case, although I am a physician and I treat patients all day long, I'm more concerned with the earth cessation of respiration. And for that reason, I do believe that eating cellular meats would take enormous environmental pressures off of the planet. Although it would not be good for our coronary arteries, it would cause heart attacks and strokes and cancer, but it would be good for our planet.
Well, what about that, Gary?
Actually, the energy inputs for the production of cell meat are extraordinary. So, I mean, there are serious...
Potentially, but not as bad as environmental pressures from our current
I think that that's a solution that we don't really have time for.
Don't have time is in the sense of saving the planet.
Well, right. My parents always sort of thought if you didn't have meat on the table, it wasn't a meal.
Yes.
That is an idea that a lot of people still have.
Yes.
And I think that's what we need to get away from. And rather than this idea of, well, let's make, you know, impossible burgers, or let's have
bacon tasting vegan,
you
something.
Know, exactly.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about a couple of things. One, about the politicians that you mentioned, and we're talking kind of a UK, US, Western view, perhaps, on what you believe, Ron or Gary, the politicians and some of the audience should tackle. But then what was coming to my mind were, you know, some stories that I covered this week on the World Service, which was Gaza and Sudan and Haiti. And these are places that are potentially facing famine. Those authorities, they have so many issues to face, very basic issues, that veganism, if it makes it onto the list at all, is an unlikely possibility.
But it should be the only, because when you look at what's being airlifted into these places, what is it? It's calories. These starving people need calories to stay alive. They need plants. Not fresh kale. They need grain. They need beans, and they need water. That's how you stay alive.
Thank you for that. I want to play another message that came into us, this time from Mexico. This is Gomez.
We hardly eat any meat because our income is too low. Are we saving the planet?
Is Gomez saving the planet because he just doesn't have the money to buy meat?
He is. When you look at a prior question by the Indian gentleman, I think, mm-hmm. it was posed, how can veganism combat climate change? And I think the two major ways that you see this happening are animals produce methane, and that methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide. But the other thing that people sometimes are not as aware about is that in order to create all the massive amounts of feed for the animal agriculture, we have to take over ecosystems that bury carbon in the earth, and those are jungles and forests and wetlands, and all of these places that store carbon from the atmosphere are completely tilled up and put into grain production to feed animals.
And that's on, and even with regenerative agriculture, you'll need more land. If you're going to do regenerative agriculture, you're going to need more land, and there's going to be, and you know, it's very interesting.
I disagree with that.
Well, all right.
Well, let's get into that a little bit.
You don't think we need more land?
Them's fighting words.
Well, all right. All right.
So I'm the founder of a regenerative organic nonprofit.
Self-interest.
The reason why we founded it is to try and establish a model of how small farmers, local farmers, can grow food for a community that helps the health of the community, that helps the health of the planet, and yet still survive and make a living economically without any support from the government.
Well, that's a different question. But the literature is... Okay.
So on our board sits the chief executive of the Rodale Institute. The Rodale Institute is one of the world's, if not the world's, authority on organic regenerative agriculture. And the bottom line is they have had the world's longest running comparative trial between conventional production of crops and organic regenerative. The yields are the same.
I understand what you're saying, but if the solution is we're going to continue to eat what we're eating, but we're going to produce it with regenerative agriculture, you would have to have more land, much more land. And also the sequestration of carbon. If you have cattle in a regenerative system, which is what most regenerative models are arguing, that basically we're going to eat the same way that we're eating, only we're going to be doing it through regenerative methods. The sequestration of carbon doesn't really...
I get you.
Quick response from Ron, go ahead.
We're trying to show that you don't need cattle.
Well, all right, fine. That's fine. Regenerative without cattle...
You're on board. Yeah. We got agreement.
Yeah.
Okay. But I was thinking about land. Sheep, for example, goats, you know, it's often very poor soil, poor land that they are put on. That land wouldn't be used for crops, I don't think.
Well, if you look around the world at places that have poor land, basically like subsistence herding on arid places with minimal vegetation, most of these places are like that because of farming methods. It was humankind's agricultural methods that destroyed, for most of these places, a once verdant place.
Just want to go back to my audience for a moment just to make sure. Anybody have a question? Anybody like to jump in? Yes, hello. Nice to meet you. Welcome to the Oxford Literary Festival. We're at Worcester College.
I'm Jasper. I was wondering if you could entertain a more multifaceted food system, seeing that some of the key plant crops are symbiotic with certain animal systems. So if you think of orchards or nut growing, often the best system there is to have grass underneath, which you otherwise have to spray off or mow. So to have animal systems that often are difficult to describe as torturous or causing suffering, symbiotic with those crops, what do you think about that?
Well, there are regenerative systems that recommend that. And just maybe I can explain what the young gentleman is talking about.
Yeah, that's Jasper, yeah.
So, for example, instead of having animals in a stockyard or being fed in a concentrated animal feeding operation, tons of grain that was grown, you know, 1,000 miles away and then being taken to slaughter, well, you could put them in an orchard. And by the way, those animals were never meant or evolved to eat this grain anyway. They were meant to graze, right? The animals that we eat. So instead, what he's saying is you could have an orchard with perennial plants, right, which are excellent for sequestering carbon from the atmosphere because you don't keep tilling up the ground. The roots stay there. They grow from year to year, take carbon from the atmosphere, put it into the ground. And the nice floor of the orchard is grass. And then you can have animals grazing on that grass, eating what they evolved to eat. You could have them defecating and have fertilizer for the fruit trees. It sounds like a beautiful system, doesn't it? And never till the soil. And that sounds excellent. But there's a bit of a problem there.
What's the problem, Ron?
Well, the problem is the animals are not cost-free to maintain. You know, you have to take care of those animals. They're just not living on grass and just sitting there. They need shelter. They need veterinary care. And then what's the end point of these animals? Are they just going to be taken care of until the end of their natural lives and then let to die? No. In order to economically validate the system, they will be slaughtered and eaten.
Jasper, do you want to follow up?
Yeah, that's precisely my point. I'm saying a symbiosis of different food systems with an outcome. So that those systems may not have the ethical dilemmas that factory systems do. Granted, especially to Gary here, that they still entail the issue of ending a life. That's what I'm saying.
A better life.
A varied food system.
And I agree with you. There is less suffering in a system in that. However, the end point is that the animal flesh that is eaten there still will cause coronary artery disease, diabetes, hypertension, cancer. And then you do have to end a sentient being's life.
You'll never also be able to feed large numbers of people that way.
No, you will not.
You know, it'd be much more expensive. But, I mean, I think there is a fundamental issue. I mean, look, for me, the ultimate concern is violence. You know, I have been in slaughter situations which are worse and slaughter situations which are better, but they're all terrible because non-human animals are sentient. They're subjectively aware. They have a sense of themselves. They have a connection to a future self, and you're killing them. And so my basic question to you is, if you don't have to make that choice, if you don't have to kill in order to survive, why would you do it?
Thank you very much for your question, Jasper. I just want to get back to a couple of other aspects before we come to the end of our hour. This is anecdotal from a couple of friends who went vegan. They really wanted to from the moral perspective, but they found energy low and mood low. And it was the mood aspect that reverted them back to vegetarianism.
I will tell you this. I'm going to be 70 years old in another month. If I had any more energy, it would be frightening. as a matter of fact, I would like to challenge anybody in the audience to come and arm wrestle me or something. Yeah. But no, I feel enormous amounts of energy. Ron is trying to tell me I need to sleep more. And I'm telling him for the past 70 years, I haven't had more than 5 hours a night. But I actually think animal, and Ron can speak to this, he's a physician, I think that animal products have more effect on your mood in terms
Absolutely.
Of downing.
Maybe it's missing something in nutrition. I don't know.
It's called cognitive bias.
Right.
There is a bias. We all have it. I have it too. There's a bias where we're looking for a reason to continue what our tendency
the way we
to
used
do.
To do it. I want to make sure I'm not missing any questions in the audience before I finish up. Anyone, a question for Gary or Ron before we finish? Lovely to have you back with us. If you don't mind giving your name again and where you're from. Thank you.
Hi, it's Angela Wilson, GP. I just wanted to mention the fruit and veg issue. I think that's the main issue. I know that pulses are much cheaper than animal products. The main issue for cost is the large number of fruit and veg that are recommended for people to eat and how expensive that is. So I'm just wondering whether you can see a role for there being an increase in the number of people that are actually growing their own fruit and veg. We had this dig for victory.
Absolutely.
In the World War. I think we need that back again,
yes.
Personally. And can you think of a way to encourage people to do that? And
well, during World War II in America, we had the Victory Gardens, and it's estimated within 1 year, just by growing vegetables and fruits in their backyard, individuals were able to provide 40% of all the produce eaten in the United States during those years.
But doesn't it depend, particularly when we come to fruit, what fruit we're talking about or vegetables, like avocados, which are incredibly popular right. at the moment, right. but they're not environmentally friendly, are they, well, to grow?
No, they take up a lot of water, and so do things like almonds, of course.
Almond milk.
And other things.
Yeah, alternative yeah. milks. Yeah.
But the bottom line is animal products are a lot worse.
Yeah, a pound of beef takes up 100 times the water resources than a pound of grain.
You can have like 20 people living off of an acre of land, whereas it takes like 3.25 acres to produce food for one non-vegan, one omnivore for a year. I mean, the inefficiencies are breathtaking.
One thing I just wanted to get back to was the emotional state.
Yes.
So one of the callers mentioned that she began to feel somewhat blue or depressed.
Yeah, the mood, low mood.
And all I can say is that our guts are fiber-driven, they're plant-driven, and our guts produce more serotonin, which is the feel-good neurotransmitter, than the neurosynapses in our brain do. And it is uniform that I see that people come to me, I'm a primary care working doctor, and when they come off animal foods and they eat whole plant foods, we take them off their antidepressants.
Yep.
Would you consider yourselves foodies? Do you love food?
I was at one time.
But not anymore?
My foodiness has been redirected to other focuses within food.
I ask this because I think for some listening, they might find what they see on offer with veganism as boring, to be brutally frank.
Anything but.
Are you a foodie?
I enjoy eating vegan food. I don't obsess about eating food, but I enjoy vegan food.
Because I'm wondering, are there, you know, the obsessive foodie vegans as But maybe that's a question I'll throw out.
These are habits, and they can be changed.
Okay, talking about change. Nice segue there, Gary. Has anybody in this audience changed their mind about veganism during this conversation? Hands, please, if there are any. One change here, one change here. Dr. Wilson, what have you changed?
Well, I think I'm coming to the conclusion that I'm going to give a go at veganism and work around the family.
Gary and Ron, very much starting the clapping there. And over to you, Annie. We spoke to you at the beginning. You're vegetarian. What are you thinking now?
I've been reminded of the different values that come with plant-based eating.
Thank you all very much. You've been a wonderful audience. And thanks so much to my guests, of course, Gary Francione and also Ron Weiss. I'm Lula McGovern. You've been listening to Forward Thinking, an edition of the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service. The producer was Julian Siddle. Do join us next time when we'll be discussing whether feminism can fix the internet.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right?
Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.